Okay, so this evening we're looking at Rav Moshe Feinstein, who I think has the distinction of being the most prominent posek of the 20th century. That's even people who haven't heard of so many of the other names that we've seen or are going to see in the next coming weeks, you know, have still heard of Rav Moshe Feinstein. He was a Rosh Yeshiva in New York from 1936, that's till 1986, so for 50 years. He was born in Russia in 1895, so spent the first 40 years of his life or so in Russia, qualified as a Rav there, and served as a Rav for 20-odd years, fought with communism. And whether he was expelled or escaped doesn't make a lot of difference. Came to New York in 1936 and was essentially a Magid Shir Rosh Yeshiva. And the way that Psak Halakha works is that you don't have an official position as a Posek Hador or a Gadol Hador, but it was a reputation that he earned. It's one of the strange sort of quirks of either Siyata Dishmai or fate, or however you want to understand it, is that sort of, I don't know if Rav Moshe Feinstein was the most distinguished, greatest Talmid Chacham who lived at that time, or perhaps there were others who were on par with him, but it was Siyata Dishmai for him that he was the one that became the household name. He was the one that became recognized as the Posek Hador. There might have been others of greater, you know, equal stature hidden in corners, places didn't want to make themselves known in the way that he did, and you know, he made himself known only because he felt a need for it. But he was certainly the one who had the prominence. There were seven volumes of Igrot Moshe published during his lifetime, and then an eighth and a ninth volume, which were published posthumously. Some of those tshuvot in the eighth volume, I think, were written up in his latter years. His son-in-law and his grandson acted as his gabayim, and they wrote up some of those tshuvot. And I think there's, like I've, you know, said with one or two of the others, that, you know, there's hardly a week goes by when I'm not asked a shaila where I don't have to have, you know, recourse to Rav Moshe Feinstein in one way or another. He covered absolutely every area of halacha and must have written, you know, well over a thousand tshuvot. He's not necessarily regarded as being the final word in every matter, but he's certainly regarded as being an important word in every matter. And, you know, certain things, you know, the minhag is different to what Rav Moshe said, but certainly as a consideration, his points are very important. I think more so than anybody else we've seen to date, he deals with, again, not only the old questions of, you know, what do you do if you miss out Yalev Yavot type things, but deals with the range of what I would call modern issues, both in terms of changes in society and also in terms of changes in technology. Some of the issues that he addresses from the perspective of change in technology, technology's moved on a little bit since then. Different understandings of how things work, etc. Also in terms of sociology, one can argue that the situations and circumstances are different 50 years on to what they were when he first wrote the tshuvot. Nevertheless, his opinion in all these matters is very important. I mean, a good example, I think, of sort of where technology has changed somewhat is Rav Moshe discusses the question of, he was one of the earliest poskim to discuss heart transplants. Now, he discussed transplants in, I think, 1968 or 1969. The first heart transplant was in 1969. So I think it must have been after the first heart transplant, his tshuva. And he says, straightforward, he says that it's ritzicha, it's murder of two people. He says it's murder of the donor and murder of the recipient. That's so from the donor, it obviously touches into the question of brainstem death. And that's the whole question, really, with regard to what it doesn't address the issue clearly there. So there's a whole debate as to what did Rav Moshe really hold about brain death. But although he says it's a murder of the recipient, why? Because nobody who gets a heart transplant lives for very long. Now that was in the late 60s, early 70s, and heart transplants have moved on very, very significantly since then. I think it's generally regarded, it's well past the, we've got a medical expert here this evening, but it's well past the experimental stage, we would say. And, pretty much every operation carries with it a certain amount of risk. But essentially, anybody who gets a new heart, is extending their life. So anybody would simply say that, Rav Moshe rules out heart transplants because it's a murder of both the donor and the recipient, would not be a fair representation of Rav Moshe Feinstein's view on the matter. Similarly, he's got a tshuva on smoking. That's where he says that the smoking's not no reason to offer it. It's the medical evidence against it is unproven. Shomer p'tayim Hashem. Hashem looks after the fools, and you don't need to offer smoking. Whereas, again, that was a tshuva written, I think, in the 1960s, if I remember correctly. The medical evidence has piled up, against that now. And anybody who smokes and tells you they rely on Rav Moshe, that's they've probably never even seen the tshuva inside. But subsequent poskim, reassess the things, in the light of subsequent evidence. In any event, he certainly does address, a very wide range of issues. We're going to look at some of them this evening, and we'll touch perhaps on some other issues that he doesn't mention directly. And we'll see that some of them reflect sociological issues, some of them technical issues. And we'll see how Rav Moshe related to them. Some of them which are very, very important in terms of, psak halakha, for the current day. So we'll start off with a question where I think he might have been a little bit ahead of his time in a certain sense, and he's talking in the first question that I've got here. I mean, I could have brought 200 suitable Shelot and Tshuvot to address this evening. I brought, I think, six or seven, really going through just one volume off the bookshelf. And there could have been much more. Discuss the question about dismissal of teachers. The question is essentially that you don't like a teacher. It doesn't need to be a teacher, really. It could be any member of staff that you've got in your business. The cases he's talking about is teachers, but you've got a teacher, a member of staff that you don't really want. You don't feel they're doing the job the way, particularly the way you want them to do it. They've got a certain amount of tenure. And can you just get rid of them without any good reason? So let's see what he has to say about it. We'll look in the second paragraph. So you've hired a person. No, I think they're all taken, I'm afraid. That's Shesachru Melamed Stam. They hired him. Just we needed a teacher. Imosem Melachto Be'emunah. So he's doing his job in good faith. He's explaining clearly to the class what he's trying to teach them. And he's making sure that they review the material properly, as they need to. And he's not spending the time in the classroom playing battleships with them on the blackboard. And he's got the right religious, he's setting the right religious example for them. The Talmidim can learn from him. So it's not just the text that he's teaching them, but he's also teaching them what it means to be a from Jew. Humanamed Haraoliot More, Humanamed Talmidim, then he's the right type of person to be a teacher. V'yef Shalasalko, and you can't just get rid of him like that. And even if when you appoint him, saying that, listen, you know, at the end of the year we might decide to dismiss you, af below shumtana, just because, you know, we're appointing you for a year and we'll see how we feel at the end of the year. It's not clear at all if you can just get rid of him. Mishum Shah director and Vamanalim Nivraru Rakla Sotka Din HaTorah, Shula Shem Shamayim, because ultimately this is a Jewish school and the headmaster and governors are working within a Torah framework. The Kevan Shelestalek Belotana Vadai Einul Shem Shamayim, just getting rid of a person because you don't feel they're dynamic enough, you don't feel they're modern enough, whatever it is. Ein lahem zechut, you haven't got the right just to get rid of a person for that reason. But efshar she'ein tana'am klum, and the fact they said at the outset, well, we might be only appointing you for a year, doesn't mean anything. V'im shecharu hu stam afshar contract natnu rak al zman kshana shnatayim, and if they, even the fact that they've given the person a contract for a year, for 2 years, v'aday lo nechshav kivitnai l'salko kashir tu af blotana, still doesn't mean to say that you can get rid of them at the end of that period of time without a good reason. V'ein yecholim l'salko kashilek etana sheyizku al pidin, unless they've got a good reason they would stand up in Beit Din, you can't get rid of the person. Now, I think this is reflecting what is, you know, basically common legal practice, you know, now in terms of employment law. Is anybody here involved in employment law at all, or anybody employ people that you've tried to dismiss at any stage? From what I understand is that now that, you know, if the person, once the person's worked whatever period of time it is, then just the fact that you don't, you're not so excited by them, you don't feel they're, you know, so cutting edge, or there's somebody else you'd rather bring in instead, that's what they call constructive dismissal. That's, you can't do it. And that's essentially the principle that Rav Moshe is creating as well. It's true, you might find somebody who tells better class stories in the classroom and has the Talmidim, you know, lapping up his every word. You might find a person who is a bit cooler as far as the kids are concerned, which is what one wants nowadays in terms of a teacher. Okay, but without you know, unless you can prove that he's not doing his job properly, then you can't just get rid of the person because you don't like the look of their face or whatever it might be. It's clear he's very strongly protecting the rights of the employee to a certain degree at the expense there of the employer, but he's certainly I think moving towards this position of, if the person's doing a reasonable job, then unless you can show that he's not doing a good job, there might be somebody else out there who you think can do a better job, or you might not be so excited by him, you still can't just get rid of him like that. In the final paragraph, he discusses a related question, which is, what if, you know, sometimes, you know, you just haven't got, the school's contracted, and you haven't got enough students in the school, so you need to lay off some staff. Or in a business context, you know, business is not going so well, so you need to lay off some staff. So is it reasonable to say, last in, first out? Or is there perhaps another way that it has to be dealt with? Perhaps it should be by lottery, or what principle should be used? So he says that it all depends a little bit on, you know, what the minhag hamakom is there, what the general practice is in that sort of working environment, how it works. So that's the first question, which I would say is addressing a sociological phenomena rather than a technical phenomena. The next question that I've brought here is the question of whether or not you can donate blood for payment, and of course the related question will be whether or not you can donate organs for payment. Bernard, I think, is that a question?
Yeah. Where's the
That's
sensible moral advice.
I think he's saying more than that. I think he's saying that, you're right, he's not including here He's not bringing any raya from anywhere. What he's saying is that according to Din Torah, you can't dismiss a person for anything other than not doing their job properly. But you're right. I think he's looking here more of minhag. Sorry. No, I think he's giving what he would call a Torah response to the question. You think he shouldn't have been asked this question because it's not a strictly religious issue? No, I think he's establishing what in a Torah context, even if you've got, let's say legally you're allowed to just, the person's got a contract for a year, and you're allowed to dismiss them at the end of the year because, yeah, okay, they were all right, but they weren't anything special. Right? Is that an acceptable Jewish approach to employer's responsibility to the employee? That's in part, of course, a lot of choshen mishpat issues are dependent on minhag hamedina. That's not just in the wider medina, but in the sort of more local, Jewish, community, in terms of what's common practice, what does an employer and an employee have in mind when they enter into that? Yeah, what's their expectation exactly? And I think in some, to some degree, he's establishing what that, what that should be. But perhaps he's also, trying to react against, and I don't know what sort of, I don't remember what year this was written in, and I don't know what sort of the employment situation in New York at the time was like, but it might have been there was a very cutthroat atmosphere where Malamdin were being hired, and if they weren't exciting, then they got booted out, and perhaps he was responding to that in some way. Yeah.
There was a point that the European Malamdin were very common, and
right,
people were beginning to reject that.
Might well be that you've got an old Rebbe from Europe who sorry?
There were a lot of people from there that were
That's probably their modern pedagogical skills were lacking. They were doing a reasonable job, but they weren't at the cutting edge. And, perhaps in some way he was, he's responding to that. But you're right, there isn't, he's not bringing any Talmudic proofs in this regard. And we'll see also as we go through some of the other tshuvot that I think perhaps more so than anybody we've seen to date in this series of Shiurim, Rav Moshe was a machadesh. He wasn't frightened of making his own suggestions how to learn a sugya or to derive an idea from a sugya, or in this case, not even bringing the sugya into the equation. Okay, let's look at the question of donating blood for payment. So can you allow the doctors to take blood from you for the sake of ill people who'll need it? And he goes on to explain exactly what the how exactly this works, and they put it into blood banks. In the fourth line, Imra Shai Bishvil HaRevach Shemishalmin Ba'adzeh Shud Tzarech LaHamaot. So you need the money, and can you go and donate blood so you can get money? I think certainly at one stage in the States, I don't know if it's still true, maybe our American representative will know, certainly at one stage in the States that you got paid for giving blood. They need blood donors and you got paid. That's I remember when I was in yeshiva, there was when this tshuva came up, somebody had the story of somebody they knew had gone to give blood, and because they needed money, whatever, they were doing it for the money, and the nurse was telling them, oh, this is such a mitzvah that you're doing this, I'm so impressed with you and everything. Then in the end they wouldn't take the money for it after all. That's in any event, so he brings a sugya here in Bava Kama. Plige tonight, Rabbi Akiva de Matnitin Soved, Ein Adam Rashai Lachvol Ba'atzmo. Rabbi Akiva, as cited in a Mishnah, holds that a person is not, as it were, Balim on his own body. A person, that we don't own our own bodies. Our bodies belong to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore we're not allowed to harm ourselves. Rabbi Akiva Bivraita, but Rabbi Akiva cited in a Braita, Soved Adam Rashai Lachbol Batzmo, holds that actually a person is allowed to harm themselves. So that would be what really the question is here. If giving blood is harming yourself in some way, so are you allowed to harm yourself or not allowed to harm yourself? The Rambam says, you're not allowed to harm yourself. And he says that's essentially the way that we paskin. So at this stage, it would seem that Rav Moshe is saying, to give blood for something which isn't a medical necessity, you're not allowed to do. Who says you're allowed to be chovel batzmo? Even if you're going to get some benefit, you're going to get a financial benefit from it yourself. So at this stage, he's indicating that it's going to be prohibited. But now we're going to see he's machadesh a bit, and he makes some suggestions. Aval b'chabal azu lahotzi dam al pi hashgachat harofim, yesh tam gadol shelo leso. We could say this type of self-inflicted wound might well be permitted. Dahamatzi no shebdorot hakodmim hayuno agim lahakiz dam. In actual fact, in Talmudic times, we know from the Gemara and the Rishonim, they used to do bloodletting. They used to think that bloodletting was a good thing if you had too many of the wrong humours in you. So then you would let some blood, and you would blood would sort of course around your body faster, and you'd feel better for it. Even just to make themselves feel a little bit better. Vim itasha, the gam itasha marmashmel, porsidama, koltlatin yomim binura av ad arbaim shana. That's you should actually let blood every 30 days till you're 40. Yachakachat shishim shanachat, shashanachat lishte chodashim. Then from 40 to 60, you should only do it every 2 months. But afakar shishim achat legimu chodashim. And even after you're 60, you should still be letting blood on a fairly regular basis every 3 months. So I'm shambarash if I got my money out. That's v'lachein, skipping a line. Ashenishtane achakakubum is man harambam. So even though it's true nowadays things are different, medical situation we regard as a bit differently. Nevertheless, and the Rambam is not so keen on bloodletting. That's nevertheless, skipping a line or two. Mikomakom v'adai gam ata ikigam refuah bazeh delo yeshinu gadol kolkach. He says there's still a medical benefit from it nowadays. It's not just as marked as it was in Talmudic times, but there's still some medical benefit from it. V'gam hayom motziin harofim kimat blotzar. Also nowadays, it's not a big chabalah to have blood let from you. V'lachein esha ein leso b'chabalah zu d'hakazat dam. And therefore, perhaps this type of self-inflicted wound we don't need to say is prohibited. V'harotze lahakel ein nimchot bo. Person who is meikol and gives blood, ein nimchot bo, then you shouldn't object to them. Kevan shis farah gadol. I think we've got good grounds to allow it. So Rav Moshe's tshuva here is kind of interesting. Talking about where you're giving it, doing it for payment. I assume that if you were doing it not for any payment, he would be even more reticent to allow it. But he's saying it's permitted on two grounds. Number one, that he still believes there's a health benefit. So he's going against the way the Rambam paskens in terms of harming yourself. So that's, again, is showing part of confidence and bravery of Rav Moshe's psa. He's going against the Rambam in terms of saying you're not allowed to harm yourself. He agrees you're not allowed to harm yourself. He says this is actually beneficial for you. You're not harming yourself. And in even beyond that, it's not really, there's no real sakana involved. It's a prick of a needle. It's not real Kabbalah. What Rav Moshe would hold about giving a kidney or something like that, which is very different, certainly selling a kidney, it's not clear. You know, you can hardly say that selling a kidney is a therapeutic benefit to the donor, and also to say that, you know, there's no tsar and there's no sakana at all, also wouldn't, or a sense of chabalah, that also wouldn't be true. Of course, with giving kidneys, when the person is when you've got an identified recipient, that's going to be a different halachic question. So that, you know, will usually move into the realms of pikuach nefesh, as opposed to giving blood for a blood bank, which isn't direct pikuach nefesh. So there is some discussion amongst the contemporary poskim about whether or not you're allowed to give blood where there's no direct pikuach nefesh involved. Some contemporary poskim have suggested that if you're getting in chutz la'aretz to give blood is against the din, because you're making a chabala in yourself, you're making a wound, self-inflicted wound, where it's not to save Yisrael. That's but I once asked Moriv Rabbi Harav Lichtenstein this question. He was emphatic that there's no problem with it whatsoever. I think he essentially held that there's no chabala involved in giving blood. But also you've got a question of of Chilul Hashem as well. That if the Jewish community said we're not giving blood, then it would be quite reasonable for blood banks. Jew goes into hospital and needs a transfusion, Chas v'Shalom, that he wouldn't get it. The next tshuva I brought is one that I don't fully understand. I've only brought part of the tshuva. The question that he was asked was, are you allowed to take a job as a tax inspector? And it could happen that you'll find some nice Hamish Yidden who've been not just cooking the cholent, but cooking the books. And you're going to have a problem of Moser, that it's your job as a tax inspector to report any shady business. And you're running the risk of putting your fellow mitpalalim that's behind bars at Her Majesty's pleasure, or whatever it might be. That's such things, of course, have never been heard of, Baruch Hashem. But are you allowed to do that? So his conclusion is that you're allowed to do it. The reason his conclusion is interesting. He says, why are you allowed to take on this job? He says, because if you don't do it, somebody else is doing it. You're not making a real impact. The fact that they're going to have a tax inspector. It's not if you don't apply for the job with the Inland Revenue that lots of people will be able to do some funny business with their books and get away with it. No, if you don't, every job that's applied for, every job that there is, you've got 30, 40, 50 applicants. There are plenty of other people who are going to do it. So what you're doing is not mashmoti. It's not really significant. That's the reason that he says it's permitted. It's interesting that it seems that otherwise he would hold that it's prohibited. There's a whole question about the din of Moser, the din of whether or not you're allowed to, under what circumstances you're allowed to report a person to the authorities, where he's going to be punished not in accordance with Torah law. That's, and its whole discussion, it's unfortunately had contemporary exposure about a year or 2 years ago with certain child abuse cases here in this country, and there was a clear directive, certainly from Rabbonim in Northwest London, to the fact that there's no issa of Moser there at all, and that if you're aware of anything of that nature, should be taken straight to the authorities. But here it's a financial matter, so it's a machloket in the poskim. Rav Moshe seems to think there is an issue of Moser. If you know that your Jewish next door neighbour is not paying any tax, and it irritates you that he's just built an extension in his back garden which is cutting out your daylight or whatever, and you know that he's able to afford it because he can't, he's not paying tax, it seems that Rav Moshe would hold that it's also for you to shop him. But other poskim do hold that it's permitted. The issue of Moser only applies in a case where a person is, their life is going to be put at, put in danger. And they're going to suffer particularly because they're Jewish. Nowadays it's get a hefty fine. He's not going to be any worse because he's Jewish. But certainly that seems to be Rav Moshe's opinion. Yeah.
Don't you have a duty to let, if you know someone that is cooking the books, let the government know?
It seems not. It seems not. It seems not. Not unless you're a tax inspector. It seems, I remember learning the sugya a couple of years back, it seems there's no, you know that your next door neighbour is cheating on the on his income tax. You don't have to, it's not your job to go and phone up the Inland Revenue or the police. If you know your next door neighbour is going around causing grievous bodily harm to people, that's a different matter. So he's, you know, he's defrauding the revenue. So you might feel that that's a form of harm to society, but you've got no obligation to shop him. If you want to, because you're annoyed about his extension or you don't want him as a neighbour, then vakasha. But yes, that's the point I'm making. That's Rav Moshe seems to hold that you can't. There are poskim that say you can. So nobody holds you would have to in this case because there's no civil law that you have to. Right? So in cases where there's a civil law that you have to, then it'll become a bit more complex. But it's certainly a contemporary issue. It does seem that Rav Moshe though holds that you shouldn't. The Facebook posting was a little bit misleading. I said, what does Rav Moshe Feinstein hold about bungee jumping? I don't know if he'd ever heard of bungee jumping, and he doesn't address it explicitly, but he does discuss dangerous sports. And he's got an interesting, a very interesting take on the situation. Nishalti me'achad, I was asked, imutalit parnes, mimischak zurikata kadurim. So can you make a living by the game of throwing balls? Shenikra ball balaz. I think he means, can you become a professional baseball player in America? And I have to say, this, I don't remember the name of the Australian cricketer who was killed. What was his name? Confused. No, this is this tshuva has some bearing on that on that situation. That's
throwing balls. It's probably American football.
Okay, that's or baseball
it's
or
probably
that's
more dangerous than baseball.
Okay, he's not talking about ping pong. No. That's okay. So you know, this was then perhaps throw some light on that. As I say, it's not talking about ping pong. That's Shieshla Khush the Sakana. You know, it's dangerous. It's dangerous. We saw it was dangerous to be a professional cricketer. Gidira le Khadmi Kama Alafim Shenistakin. One in several thousand players is in danger. Right? You know, it's a small chance, but it's a real chance. Veshavdi Shelani Dati Yishlatir. I think that there's not a problem at all, or I think it's permitted at least to say, Taham first Bavava Metzia, Dafkuf Yud Bet. Now, this is a sugya in Masechet Bavava Metzia towards the end. Akrad Ve'ilav Nosei Nafsho, the Pasuk Ve'ilav Nosei Nafsho, this is why a person is endangering his life. Mipnei Man Itzlaba Ilanu Masaret Atzmola Mita. Why is a worker, why does he get caught on a tree and why does he end up dying? Is it not because he's being paid to do a certain job, and that job can endanger his life? Almad mutali panes afka sheika chashash sakana l'ofen rachok. And this is interesting. He's saying, so you're allowed to take a job that is dangerous, provided that it's two provisos. Number one, that it's lit parnas. You're getting a parnasa from it. And number two, the chashash sakana is ofen rachok. It's a very slim chance that you're going to become a cropper. We'll discuss it in just a moment. Even though if you're a professional cricketer, you might bounce the ball and kill somebody else. It's unlikely, but it might happen. Mutar, it's still permitted for you to do this. You're not allowed to kill yourself. You're not allowed to kill other people. So if you're allowed to endanger your own life, you don't need to worry about them either if they're putting themselves into that situation. Small chance of danger, and it's the tzarech parnasa. אם כן, גם בחשש סכנת אחרים, נמי יש להתיר בחשש רחוק כזה. So also if it's a small chance that others will get harmed, that's also fine. וגם אם לא נאמר כן לא הרשאי בעל האילן לזכור אותו. Because otherwise, you wouldn't be able to employ a person to do something dangerous forestry or what it might be. אבל ודאי מסתבר שהוא דווקא כשאחר גם כן נכנס לזה ברצונו. Obviously, the other party needs to be a willing party in it. You can't endanger somebody else's life with negligence. Now, Rav Moshe is clearly saying here two things. He's saying, has to be a small chance, only a small chance of danger, and you're doing it l'tzarech parnasa. It seems that he's being matir this form of playing, whether it's American football or baseball or whatever it is, or cricket. It's only being matir if you're doing l'tzarech parnasa. To do it not l'tzarech parnasa, it's true, there's only a small chance of danger, but nevertheless, why should you put yourself in any danger if it's not l'tzarech parnasa? On the other hand, even if it's very dangerous, he's not going to allow you for tzarech parnasa. Now, one of the big questions always is going to be, what's the definition of danger? You know, not danger. You know, anybody here done bungee jumping? You've done skydiving, right? Skydiving, safe? Perfect.
Perfect. Well, it depends on what you call safe. I mean, the stats were very, very minimal.
So you know, it's all a question of how do you find dangerous. You know, not dangerous. There's a person who goes out every Sunday afternoon doing parachute jumps will tell you it's perfectly safe. It's safer than sitting at home. Right? Whereas somebody like me, I would say don't even think of it. You know, it's terribly dangerous. That's don't do it. So definition of safe. Once you're, if there's one in two chance of being killed, everybody would agree that that's not safe. Except the people, of course, say it's not going to happen to me. Those are difficult things to define. The other question is, does everything have to have solely a monetary consideration in terms of what we're saying? So if it's lehit parnes, you can do it, right? But if it's not lehit parnes, if it's not to earn a living, you can't do it. You've got your professional basketball player or baseball, American football player, right? So he's earning $40,000 a week, right? Well, you know what? He doesn't need to play next week. That's play 1 week a year, and he says that's good, $40,000 2 weeks a year, okay? And you know what? He's got kids at Jewish schools, 3 weeks a year. But he doesn't need to do more than that, and then he's not entirely parnes. Nobody's suggesting that wouldn't be the case, so. You want to, you find it enriching, enlightening, uplifting, whatever, to go hang gliding. It must be, quite a nice, pleasant experience once you get over the fright, over the, the downs, to glide around for an hour or two. Must be very nice. Does that have no meaning to it at all? I don't know. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. I think from this that Rav Moshe, would not be keen on bungee jumping. On the other hand, the person who's gone bungee jumping would say it's perfectly safe. I once read an article by Bill Bryson where he gave some statistics of how many people. Easter Monday is always the biggest day in A&E for accidents because everybody's busy doing their DIY. That's DIY weekend. It's springtime and people are doing DIY. So you've got people banged hammers on their on their hands and falling off ladders, all that. We had statistics of how many people had been brought into A&E over the course of the year for all sorts of things, including, people who'd had, been injured by soft furnishings. Injured by the duvet. Right, you could get injured even by the duvet. Never mind hang gliding. Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to a couple of other other issues. You know, we won't look at changing minhagim in shul. The other question comes up quite often in this country. Certainly, I don't know where this was addressed to, whether it's I assume it was in the States, but you can have changing neighborhoods. You can have a shul that he's describing was a shul that was started off as a minhag Ashkenaz shul. And then over the course of time, whether it's Sfardim moved into the area or Hasidim moved into the area, a good example is, you've got, a good example is in France. You know, you've got shuls in Paris, which till the Second World War were Ashkenazi, ancient Ashkenazi community, and now it's all North Africans. So you've got the same buildings with North Africans there, hardly any Ashkenazim. Can you change the minhag of the shul, even though the population is different? So do you have to retain the original minhag or not? He says, whilst you've still got even a small minority of the original mitpalalim, you have to retain the original minhagim. But he has a very interesting take on minhagim, and this comes up in other places in his tshuvot as well. And this is something which rabbonim are often challenged with. Rabbonim, every rabb, when they come to a shul, they want to make a few changes in minhagim, introduce one or two things, take out one or two things, etc. And you'll always have somebody who was there since the very beginning and tells that this has always been the minhag. That's Roland is very tolerant of me, but that's but you always get people. Rabbi, this is the minhag. This has an interesting. He says, if it's difference between minhag Ashkenaz and clear difference between minhag Ashkenaz and minhag Sfar. The example that he gives actually is when you do the Hoshanot on Sukkot. Do you do them after Shacharit or do you do them after Musaf? Right, those are two clearly different minhagim. You can't just overnight decide, okay, we're changing the minhag and we're doing it the other way. Says there are other things though which are less significant. He says, for example, many shuls don't say Shir Hamalot Mimamakim on the Aseret Yemei Tshuva before Baruchu, right? But many shuls do. So let's say you want to introduce that. So somebody could come along and tell you, no, our minhag is not said. What are you doing introducing that? And say, that your minhag, you didn't have a minhag. You didn't say it, but you can't say that it was the minhag. It's true, you can argue halachically that we did have a minhag not said because we held with a certain shita or whatever. But you didn't do it. If you want to introduce it now, you can introduce it. In another shuvot, he's got, he discusses about different types of minhagim, significant minhagim, less significant minhagim. He talks about changing nusach, your own nusach, from nusach Sfard to nusach Ashkenaz. Right? So he's not too bothered about that. He's not too bothered. He's bothered about changing from nusach Ashkenaz to nusach Teiman or something like that. But the Nusach Sfar, Nusach Ashkenaz, says that they're both basically the same. There are a few, few subtle differences here and there. But essentially, it's the same Nusach. You can change around that. But he's got a tshuva about moving the women's area in shul to the downstairs, which is happening in a lot of shuls now. Most shuls which are lucky enough to have an upstairs now want a downstairs as well. So most shuls that have an upstairs ladies gallery also have a space downstairs for the women as well, for those who can't manage the stairs, etc., or those who just want to be downstairs. And he's got a question: are you allowed to do that? So there are two perspectives to this question, one of which he doesn't discuss. A question in other poskim is, if you're turning part of the men's part of the shul into a women's part, is that a problem of lowering the kedusha of that that area? Because men can make up a minyan for Davar Shebikdusha. So the men's shul has greater kedusha than the women's section. If you're now making a part of the shul dedicated only for women, and it was previously used by men, then maybe you've got a problem of lowering the kedusha, and that's addressed by other poskim. But he addresses the question as to whether or not you can biklal move the women downstairs. He's much happier with a gallery upstairs than the mechitza downstairs. He says that mechitza downstairs is a bit of a chiddush. The model that we have from the Beit HaMikdash is there was a guzzustra, there was a balcony. And that's the best way to ensure there's no kalatrosh, there's no intermingling of the sexes. But, you know, okay, if you need to have a mechitza downstairs, then that's all right. And, you know, we've got shuls like here where we don't have an upstairs. But he's quite strict in his use of expressions further on. And he says that it's never the shame shamayim, this. It's women, they want to come downstairs. It's the thin end of the wedge. You know, this week they want to come downstairs. Next week they'll want to get rid of the mechitza. The following week they'll want to be sitting next to each other. And before you know it, you'll be having women scholars in residence leading shiurim at the Oneg on Friday nights and such things like that. So, you know, it doesn't quite say that, but it says it's not l'shem shamayim, and you need to tell them that this is zilzul with Minhag Yisrael, and that with the zuchut of kedushat at Beit HaKnesset, they'll be blessed min hashamayim. He has a final line there that, you know, if you're the rabbi of the shul, you don't need to lose your job over it. You know, say that at one board meeting, and if they're not going to listen to you, then you don't have. It's not a resigning matter. He discusses reading Megillah through a microphone. He is almost matir. He doesn't like doing new things, especially it's a new technology. He says in his final lines that it's, you know, as we shouldn't let people always want to change things in this country. He says, you know, Judaism isn't about change. Judaism is about Masorah. But he discusses microphones. He's misfara. He thinks that it's permitted. He thinks that he makes the observation that when a person speaks, if I lay the Megillah without a microphone, he says you're not hearing exactly my voice. What you're hearing is my sound waves coming out of my mouth are creating a chain reaction in the air, and you're hearing something else which has reached you. He says that's the same with the microphone. I think most contemporary poskim don't accept this ruling. Again, I don't remember what year this was written in. And they seem to hold that it's a totally new voice, which is a sound which has been created. Want to finish off with a very, very important two relevant shaylos and shuvot. So we'll do them in reverse order on this back page. We won't go through the laying tefillin early in winter mornings inside. So that's the question. Person's got to get to work early in the winter. Earliest time now for laying tefillin is something like 6:30. Alot HaShachar is a bit earlier than that, but certainly I don't think earlier than 6 o'clock. You've got to get to work. So some people have got if you're in a job where you've got an office to yourself, I know people who, you know, they lay tefillin at work during their coffee break or whatever it is, having a short shacharit, and that's it. But you've got people who, depending on whatever your job might be, you know, you can't, you're under supervision all the time. Perhaps you work in a factory or something like that. You haven't got time to stop and lay tefillin, and maybe the environment's not one where you're comfortable laying tefillin. So you might be able to find a quiet corner to daven sitting down or something, when, you know, somebody will think you're reading the paper or something like that. But can you lay tefillin before you go out in the morning, even though it's pitch black? So he discusses the sugya Masechet Menachot and different readings in the Rishonim. And he comes to the conclusion that as far as the Rishonim are concerned, there are enough Rishonim who say that it's all right. Even though we don't lay tefillin at night, that's because of a concern that a person will fall asleep wearing their tefillin. So in the morning, once you've got up already, you're not going to fall asleep again. Whenever I have to get up very early in the morning, that is a chashash. But that's, you're not going to fall asleep again. So in terms of putting on tefillin, if you've got no other alternative, you should put on tefillin, even though it's earlier than Zaman tefillin. But then he has an interesting discussion about the bracha. Really, the bracha you shouldn't say, because Shulchan Aruch and the standard methodology of Pesach is that you shouldn't say a bracha before it's Zman Mishayakir. But he says, you know what, I think people should say a bracha. Why? He says, because if you tell them to lay tefillin without a bracha, they think they're not really doing the mitzvah properly. And then they'll feel bad about the mitzvah, and they might not even do the mitzvah. And he says, you know, just normal people think that, you know, oh, well, if you're doing a mitzvah without a bracha, yeah, you're not really doing the mitzvah. And therefore, there's enough grounds to allow the, enough Rishonim hold that you can lay tefillin at night, which would include making a bracha, that, okay, maybe, you know, distinguished Talmid Chacham wouldn't say a bracha, but anybody else should.
Yeah.
Sorry?
We have a
little
bit of late
filling each
day.
Yeah, that counts. Yeah.
It's still not the next day.
It's that day. It's good enough. It's every 24 hours you're laying to fill. That's you laid to fill in yesterday at this time, you're laying to fill in tomorrow at this time, you've laid to fill in for today. That's well, you're lucky you've got a job where you can waltz in at 9 o'clock.
You're saying that it's the night before, it's still not.
It's that halakhically it's that day. It's because of the night. That's want to finish off with very important tshuva of Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe dealt in many tshuvot with the question, two questions. One question of civil marriage, and the other question of reform marriage. And the question, does a person who's had either of these forms of marriage, a woman, does she need a get in order to be able to remarry? And of course, if she does need a get and she doesn't get one, then there are mamzerus implications for the children. So I think it's worth us looking at this this tshuva in inside. And this was written Tafshin Kaf Gimel, so that was 1963. Hinei b'nisuei harishon hayu rak be'erkaot. So a woman's first marriage was in a civil marriage. Asher afa im yesh etzlam netinat tabat miyadol yada, even if it involves giving a ring, harei lo hayu sham edim kasherim. I can show you there were no kosher edim there. D'lo yachlo yelchu edim kasherim nerot b'kidush erkaot. What would kosher edim, good from Jews, be going to a register office ceremony for? V'nimtzar shel kidushin shayu az einam klum. So therefore, it's not a real kiddushin at all. You know, yeah, he gave her a ring in the presence of no aiding. That's meaningless. Fani don her. So if that's the only question we've got, right, and then they went off on honeymoon together and came back and decided they didn't like each other. So then, okay, so you wouldn't have a shayla. Fani don her. Rak mashedaru yachad shtei shanim. The problem is now, not just civil marriage, but you've also got common law marriage. And they live together for two years as husband and wife. Sha'anan sadi shayu biot harbe, the chazak biot harbe. We can assume they were intimate with each other on numerous occasions. The chazakan, we've got a Talmudic principle, she'en bo'el bilat znut, that a person doesn't like to behave in a sexually loose manner. Yeah, a person that. Good Jewish people, they don't have casual sex, and when they have sex, it's the Shem Kiddushin, Ubal Shem Kiddushin. So we can assume that they were living together L'Shem Kiddushin to be married. V'afim lo kavnu l'kiddushei Torah, mishum shelo hayu shomrei Torah. That's true. Okay, they hadn't learnt the sugya, so they didn't say to themselves, "Oh, you know, that's okay. We saved on the caterer and the hall, but we must remember that this, you know, we're now living together the Shein Kiddushim." They didn't think that. Ulayin sarklit kavein the kiddushei Torah. Perhaps you don't need to have in mind that, oh, I'm doing this in a halachic way. T'kevan shena saali ishav lo lazona sagi shetiyekunuya lo b'mashinivah lo acharkach. But derech biad ishut. The point is that they were continuing to have intercourse as a married couple. It's a question. Okay, so a person doesn't like to live a sexually loose life. So you can say they set up home together with the intention of living as a married couple, and that might count as nisuin. Aval kvar biyati b'sifre igrot Moshe, I said I've dealt with it elsewhere. Sheba mufkarin lavori seir usarei Torah. People who are totally not from. Ein bahem chazaka. We don't have this chazaka. People who are totally not from, they will have be'ilat znut. They will be sexually loose and casual. V'shekein poskim gam ha-mechabe v'harama. And he says that's the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch and the Rama. V'tachiti sham divrei agon Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin Shlita shemachmir bazeh. V'tastik et al-sefer v'tayin sham. This was a very famous machloket between the two poskim of America at this time, Rav Henkin, who was Rabbanit Henkin, who we had with us on Friday night, her husband's grandfather, and Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Henkin held that no, in all these cases you need to get. Rav Moshe held in all these cases you didn't need to get. Ach af kshe nachmir, and even he says, even if you hold like Rav Henkin, that it needs to be the shame, that it is, ein adam oseh bilat or bilat zanus, and a couple that are living together are doing it the shame kiddushin. Nevertheless, he says you need to have anashim kishayim who are aware of it. If they're living out in Dagenham, right, so then there's no eidut that they're living as a married couple. If they're living in Golders Green, then they're coming to shul together on the Shabbat, and she's serving the biscuits at the Ladies' Guild Kiddush and such things. So then you would have a problem, according to Rav Henkin. But if they're living in the middle of nowhere, even according to Rav Henkin, you wouldn't have a problem. And then he goes on to say that in the next paragraph, he makes the observation that nevertheless, if you can get a get, then that would be... So he said, even though I think I'm sure that it's fine and you don't need to get in these cases, ubifrat bimdina zu, there's nothing in consideration in America, shenakel hasid kadesh itzel rav kedin Torah. There are plenty of Orthodox rabbis around. You can get an Orthodox rabbi to be in the Sadiq Kiddushin. Valoratsu bishat nafsham lit kadesh kedin ha-Torah. So therefore a couple decide they're not getting married kedin Torah. Then you don't need to worry at all that they had any intention for Kiddushin. Saying in Soviet Russia in the 1960s, 1970s, right, when, they didn't have many Orthodox rabbis around, so a Jewish couple, started living together. Maybe they were living together as husband and wife, l'shem Kiddushin, because they couldn't get married. But a Jewish couple who sets us home together and is not having a Jewish marriage ceremony, then they've made a clear decision. No, they don't want to get married. And even if they're living together as a married couple, that doesn't mean anything. What he would say in a case where they've taken out a mortgage together, they've got a joint check account, and they fight over how the other one squeezed the toothpaste tube, all of which are simanim of Jewish marriage. So then, particularly the latter one, that might be different. He's saying, a couple just living together for 2 years in a rented accommodation, they've decided not, their parents keep asking them, when are you getting married? And they say, not yet. That's indication they don't want to have a state of kiddushin. Mikol makom mishtadlin anu lahasig get imesha l'chome isu eshetish. If possible, try and get a get, because it is a very serious matter. The circumstances under which I'm lenient, so that's where it's difficult to get a get. But lechatchila, he thinks that it would be. It would be good to get a get. And then he goes on to discuss what the status of the children is if there was no get. And he goes on saying there was a particular case he's discussing where there was a girl who was engaged, and then it turned out that her mother had been married, had civil marriage with somebody and not got a get from him, and then married somebody else. And this daughter was the product of that marriage. And he says, firstly, I've said all that I've said, so you don't need to worry. Second of all, he says that they're already engaged. So that's another You know, if they weren't engaged, then maybe I'd try and be a bit machmir. But they're engaged already, you know, don't certainly don't worry. He says also the fact that this is a girl who's got good midot and is snu and everything, he says that's an added sign that she must be kashera. This is a discussion in Shulchan Aruch in I think Simon Dalas in Evan HaEzer, that, you know, how do you know if a person's a mamzer or not a mamzer? So one of the considerations is what the person's midot are. As he said, you've got a person with wonderful midot, and there's only a vague, vague suffix that maybe there's some sort of shayla there. You wouldn't rely on this by itself, but in conjunction with everything else, if you've got, you know, I've said that it's mutter, and if you're still worried, I can prove to you that it's mutter because she's got good midot. That's Rav Moshe's view with regard to civil marriage. Has a very similar view with regard to reform marriage as well. If there aren't kosher edim at the wedding, so then it's not a kosher marriage. Discuss a little bit if you've got kosher edim there, but a reform rabbi. In that case, he thinks that it would be a valid marriage. So you could have a case where he says he doesn't understand why this is. Discusses the case. There's a frum fellow who's getting married in a reform or conservative synagogue. That's with the reform or conservative rabbi and Orthodox edim. So in that case, he says it would be a valid kiddushin. So it doesn't really matter who says the brachot. He's doing the shem kiddushin. He made sure that he's got kosher edim. It's kosher. He said, why does a frum person want to get married in a conservative shul like that? And the answer is probably that it was his family shul, and that's where he'd grown up all the years, and that's where his parents...
His future in-laws.
Yeah, exactly, something like that. So that's probably the answer. In any event, this is a very important psak. Even though it was, at the time, it was, you know, hotly contested, you know, between him and Rav Henkin, I believe that Rav Soloveitchik also held Ladina like Rav Henkin. They really felt that Rav Henkin's position was right. Nevertheless, I think the general position of Bat Edin is to follow Rav Moshe's, you know, astounding leniency in this regard. I think it's a very big kiddush. You can argue it's easy either way, but it's, you know, it's very brave to say in all these cases where, you know, a couple of have set up home as a married couple, and certainly, you know, reform, you know, kiddushin and everything, you know, say that it's bichlal, that's not regarded as being married in any sense that it would regard require a get. But, you know, it takes brave, broad shoulders to be able to say this. But, you know, I think it's very widely accepted. So that brings Rav Moshe to a close this evening. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, moving...